She must be mad, she tells herself. She must be absolutely insane. Chapter 20. On her birthday, Laurel receives a large bouquet of purple hyacinths and laurel from Floyd. Paul always used to put laurel in her bouquets, but this doesn't take away from the pleasure of it, the startle of his thoughtfulness. And a comparison to her ex-husband is no bad thing. No bad thing at all. Later on, he takes her to a bar in Covent Garden called Champagne and Fromage, which delivers what its name promises. Throughout the evening, Laurel keeps her eyes on her surroundings, hoping for a glimpse of Hannah, who said she was going somewhere in town with mates, when Laurel had inquired about her birthday plans. But she doesn't see Hannah anywhere, and so the mystery of the man called T stretches on. "When's your birthday?" she asks Floyd, her knife breaking into a tartine.
"The 31st of July," he replies. "Roughly."
"Roughly?" He shrugs and smiles.
"Things were a bit chaotic when I was born."
"Really?"
"Yeah. It was a steep trajectory for my parents. From the gutter to the stars."
"And the gutter was?"
He narrows his eyes and she hears a small intake of breath. "My mum was 14 when I was born. My dad was 16. No one wanted to know. They were homeless for a time. I was born in a public toilet, I believe, in a park. They took me to a hospital and left me there."
Laurel's breath catches.
"I was dressed in a blue suit and a fresh nappy, wrapped in a blanket. I had on a soft hat and mittens. I was in a box lined with a cushion. They had written my name on a piece of paper. 'This is Floyd. Please look after him.' My parents came back for me 3 days later. By that time, I'd been taken into emergency foster care. There was no way they were giving an abandoned baby back to a pair of scrawny teens with no means of support. It took them nearly a year to get me back. I think it was the fight to do so that fueled my parents' ambition."
"And how did you find out about it? Did they tell you?"
"Yes, they told me. My God, they told me. All the time. Whenever I was misbehaving, they'd march it out. 'We should have left you there in the hospital. We'll take you back there, shall we?'"
A muscle twitches in Floyd's cheek. "But do you remember anything about it?" she asks. "Anything about those days?"
"Nothing at all," he replies. "My very first memory is my dad bringing me home a plastic car. It had a little ignition." He mimes turning a key in a lock. "And it made a noise when you turned it. An engine starting. And I remember sitting in that car for an hour, maybe more, just turning that ignition, over and over. I was about 4 then, and we were living in an apartment in Boston with a balcony, views across town, all the bright lights and the ocean. So, no, I don't remember the bad days. I don't remember them at all."
"You know," she says, "you're the first person I've ever met in my whole life who didn't know their birthday." He smiles.
"Yup. Me. Too."
Laurel glances about herself. For so long, she has been the story. The woman whose daughter disappeared. The woman at the press conference. The woman in the papers. The woman who had to bury her daughter in tiny fragments. But now here is another human with a terrible story. What other stories surround her, she wonders. And how many stories has she missed all these years, while she's been so wrapped up in her own? "Your parents sound amazing," she says. Floyd blinks and smiles sadly.
"In many ways, I suppose they are,"
he says. But there's a chip of ice in his delivery. Something sad and dark that he can't tell her about. And that's fine. She'll leave it there. She understands that not everything is conversational fodder. Not everything is for sharing. They go back to Floyd's house after dinner.
Sarah Jade is curled up in the big armchair again, a laptop resting on her thighs, headphones on. She jumps slightly as Laurel and Floyd walk into the room.
"Happy birthday," she says in her whispery voice. "Did you have fun?"
Laurel is taken back by the unexpected overture.
"Yes," she says. "Yes, thank you, we did."
Floyd squeezes Laurel's shoulder and says, "I'm just popping to the loo. Be back in a minute." And Laurel knows his withdrawal is deliberate, but he's hoping she and SJ might finally have a chance to bond.
"I'm a bit tipsy," she says to SJ. "We went to a champagne and cheese place. Had more champagne than cheese."
SJ smiles uncertainly.
"How old are you?" she says. "If you don't mind me asking."
"No, of course I don't mind. I've never understood people being ashamed of their age, as if it's a failure of some kind. I'm 55, she says, "and a few hours." SJ nods.
"Are you staying over?"
Laurel asks.
"No," says SJ. "No, I think I'll go home and sleep in my own bed. I've got work tomorrow."
"Oh," says Laurel. "What sort of work do you do?"
"Bits and bobs. Babysitting, dog walking."
She lowers the lid of the laptop and uncurls her legs.
"Modelling tomorrow. For a life drawing class."
"Wow. Is that clothed or..."
"Naked,"
SJ says.
"Just as you say that there's no shame in getting older, I think there's no shame in being naked. And don't you think," she continues, "that if people say you shouldn't be allowed to ban burkinis on the beach, then, really, the natural extrapolation of that is that full nudity shouldn't be banned either? Like, who decides which bit of a body should or shouldn't be seen in public? If you're saying that one woman legally has to cover her breasts and her minge, then how can you tell another woman that she's not allowed to cover her legs or her arms? I mean, how does that even make sense?"
Laurel nods and laughs.
"Good point,"
she says. "I hadn't thought about it like that."
"No," she says. "No one thinks about anything properly these days. Everyone just believes what people on Twitter tell them to believe. It's all propaganda, however much it's dressed up as liberal right thinking. We're a nation of sheep."
Laurel feels suddenly very drunk and has to resist the temptation to say, "Bah." Instead, she nods, solemnly. She has barely absorbed another person's opinion for over a decade. She is no sheep.
"Your daughter was Ellie Mack,"
says SJ, as if reading the changing direction of Laurel's thoughts.
"Yes,"
Laurel replies, surprised.
"Did your dad tell you?" "No," she says. "I googled you. I've been reading everything on the internet about it. It's really, really sad."
"Yes," Laurel agrees. "It's very sad."
"She was really pretty."
"Thank you." "Yes, she was."
"She looked really like Poppy, don't you think?"
Laurel's head clears, suddenly and sharply, and she finds herself saying, almost defensively, "No, not really. I mean, maybe a little around the mouth, but lots of people look like people, don't they?"
"Yes,"
SJ replies.
"They do."
Chapter 21 Laurel visits her mother the next day. She'd seemed a bit perkier during her visit last Thursday, interested in Laurel's romance, gripping Laurel's hand inside hers, her dark eyes sparkling. No talk of death, no empty gaze. Laurel hopes that she will find her in a similar mood today. But the joy seems to have seeped out of her in the days between her visits, and she looks grey again, and hollow. Her first words to Laurel are,
I think there's not much time left for me now.
The words are seamless, said without pause or hesitation. Laurel sits down quickly beside her and says,
Oh, Mum, I thought you were feeling better.
Better, says her mum, and then she nods. Better.
So why the talk of dying again?
Because... She stabs at her collarbone with stiff fingers. Old.
Laurel smiles. Yes, she says. You are old. But there's more life left in you yet.
Her mother shakes her head. No. No. No life. And you. Happy. Now.
Laurel takes a sharp intake of breath. She feels the meaning of her mother's words. Have you been staying here for me?
She asks, tears catching at the back of her throat. Yes. For you. Yes.
And now I'm happy. You're ready to go.
A huge smile crosses her mother's face, and she squeezes Laurel's hand. Yes. Yes.
A heavy tear rolls down Laurel's cheek. Oh, she says. Oh, Mum, I still need you.
No, says her mum. Not now. Ellie found. You happy. I.
She prods at her collarbone.
I go.
Laurel wipes away the tear with the back of her hand and forces a smile. It's your life, Mum, she says. I can't choose when to let you go.
No,
says her mum.
No one can.
That afternoon, Laurel takes Poppy shopping. It's raining, so she suggests Brent Cross as an alternative to Oxford Street. Poppy greets her at her front door, wearing smart trousers with a jade green round neck cardigan and a floral raincoat. Her hair is in two plaits, one on each shoulder. She loops her arm through Laurel's as they run through the rain to her car across the street. Then she rolls down her window and waves frantically at her father, who stands in the doorway in his socked feet, waving back at her.
How are you?
Laurel asks, turning to glance at Poppy as she pulls out of her road.
I'm super excited, she says.
Good, Laurel replies.
And how are you?
Oh, I'm okay, I guess. A little the worse for wear after last night.
Too much champagne?
Laurel smiles. Yes. Too much champagne. Not enough sleep.
Well, says Poppy, patting Laurel's hand. It was your birthday, after all.
Yes, it was. The rain is ferocious, and Laurel switches on her headlights and pushes the wipers up to the top speed.
What have you been up to this morning?
Poppy continues in the precocious way she has that Laurel is quickly becoming used to. She replies.
Well,
I've been to see my mum.
You have a mum?
Yes, of course. Everyone has a mum.
I don't.
Well, no, maybe not one you can see, but you have a mother. Somewhere.
If you can't see something, it doesn't exist.
That doesn't make any sense.
It makes total sense.
Laurel frowns at her passenger. So... What about New York? I can't see it. Neither can you. Does that mean it doesn't exist?
That doesn't count. We could see New York on 1,000 webcams right now. We could call someone up in New York and say, please send me a photo of New York. But with my mum, well, I can't see her on a webcam or in a photo. I can't call her up. I can't even go and look at her remains in a graveyard. so my mum does not exist.
Laurel feels thrown for a minute and breathes in sharply. Would you like her to exist? Do you miss her?
No. I never even think about her.
But she was your mum. You must think about her sometimes, surely.
Never. I hated her.
Laurel glances at Poppy quickly, before returning her gaze to the road in front of her. Why did you hate her?
Because she hated me. She was mean and ugly and neglectful.
She can't have been that ugly, to have had a daughter as pretty as you.
She didn't look anything like me. She was horrible. That's all I remember. Horrible, and she smelled of chips.
Chips?
Yes. Her hair.
She peers through the rain-splattered windscreen.
It was red. And it smelled of chips.
Laurel can't quite form a response. This awful woman with greasy hair sounds so far removed from anything she'd have imagined as a mother for this self-assured, groomed, and brightly shining girl, not to mention as a romantic partner for Floyd. But then she remembers the photo she found online of Floyd when he was younger, and rather more seedy-looking, and she remembers that everyone blossoms at a different point in their life. Clearly, Floyd is blossoming right now, and maybe his life was once much, much darker. Would you say your father is happier now than he was then, Poppy?
It's a leading question, but she needs an answer. She's only known Floyd for a couple of weeks. He's without context. A man who walked into a cake shop and changed her life from the outside in.
She'd love a little insight from someone who's been on the inside for a long time. But what she gets is not what she expects. Instead of offering bland reassurances, Poppy says,
"What's happy got to do with anything? Look, we're here for absolutely no reason, whatsoever. You do know that, don't you? People try and make out there's a greater purpose, a secret meaning, that it all means something. And it doesn't. We're a bunch of freaks. That's all there is to it. A big bunch of stupid, inconsequential freaks. We don't have to be happy. We don't have to be normal. We don't even have to be alive. Not if we don't want to. We can do whatever we want, as long as we don't hurt anyone."
Laurel exhales audibly. "Wow," she says. "That's some philosophy you've got there."
"It's not a philosophy. It's life. Once you learn how to look at the world, once you stop trying to make sense of it all, it's blindingly obvious."
Laurel turns quickly to look at Poppy. "You're a very unusual girl, aren't you?"
"Yes," says Poppy firmly. "I am."
In the shopping centre, they head straight to Nando's for something to eat. Laurel skipped lunch after seeing her mother, and now she's starving. "How do you get on with SJ's mum?" she asks as they sit and wait for the food to be delivered.
"Kate."
"Is that her name?"
"Yes. Kate Virtue. She's nice. I like her. She's not very clever, but she's very sweet and kind."
"And SJ? Are you too close?"
"Ish. I mean, we're very different."
"In what sort of ways?" Laurel asks, thinking that they're both certainly rather strange.
"Well, she's an introvert. I'm an extrovert. She's good at art. I'm good at maths. She cares about everything. I care about nothing. She's humourless. I'm hilarious. She's not close to Dad. I'm super close to Dad."
She smiles. "And why do you think that is?" She shrugs.
"I guess I'm just more like him. That's all."
They stop talking as their food is delivered. Laurel watches her for a moment, studies the intensity of her focus on a bottle of ketchup, the way her forehead bunches into lines. And suddenly she finds herself thrown headfirst out of her own continuum and into a moment from her past. She is here, in this very spot, with Ellie.
She doesn't know where Jake and Hannah are in this isolated vignette. Maybe it's an inset day at Ellie's school. But she is sitting here, and Ellie is sitting there, and everything is exactly the same, but completely different. Her head spins for a second, and she grips the edge of the table and breathes deeply to center herself. She blinks and looks again at Poppy, and now she is Poppy. Definitely Poppy. Not Ellie. Poppy has not noticed Laurel's brief moment of extracorporeal time travel. She bangs the ketchup bottle to dislodge some sauce, and then replaces the lid.
"I'm really looking forward to meeting your family tomorrow night," she says. "Do you think they'll like me?"
Laurel blinks slowly. "I'm surprised you care," she says dryly.
"I don't care," Poppy replies. "I'm just interested in your opinion. Caring and being interested are two very different things."
"Yes," says Laurel, smiling. "Yes, they'll like you. You'll be a breath of fresh air."
"Good," says Poppy. "That's nice. I love being with other people's families. I sometimes wish..."
Laurel throws her a questioning look.
"Nothing," says Poppy. "Nothing."
Laurel takes Poppy into New Look. She takes her into Gap. She takes her into H&M and Zara and Topshop and Miss Selfridge. But Poppy refuses to countenance anything fashionable. Eventually they find themselves in the John Lewis children's wear department, where Poppy heads steadfastly toward a rail of printed jersey dresses.
"These,"
she says.
"I like these."
"But don't you already have a dress like this?" Laurel asks, thinking of something she'd seen her wearing that weekend.
"Yes,"
Poppy replies, pulling a dress sideways from the rail.
"I've got this one. But they've got it in another print now, look."
She pulls another dress from the rail.
"I don't have this one."
Laurel sighs and touches the fabric of the dress. "It's very pretty," she says. "But I thought we were going to, perhaps, break you out of it, you know, of your usual style." Now Poppy sighs. She looks mournfully at the dress and then up at Laurel.
"We did say that, didn't we?"
Laurel nods.
"But all that other stuff, in the other shops, it's all so trashy and scruffy."
"But you're young, and that is the joy of being young. You can wear anything and look amazing in it. Scruffy looks great when you're young. So does cheap and trashy. You can save all the smart stuff when you're my age. Come on," she urges. "One more whiz around H&M? For me?" Poppy beams and nods.
"Yes," she says. "Fine."
They pick out patterned leggings, a soft slash neck sweatshirt, a brushed flannel check shirt, a fitted t-shirt with a moustache printed on it, and a grey party dress with a chiffon skirt and jersey bodice. Laurel stands outside the cubicle, as she has stood outside so many cubicles for so many years of her life, and waits for the curtain to be drawn back. And there is Poppy, stern and uncertain in the leggings and t-shirt.
"I look vile,"
she says. "No," says Laurel, her hands going immediately to the waistband of the leggings, to center them and make them sit properly. "Here." She pulls the flannel shirt from its hanger, and helps Poppy thread her arms into the sleeves. "There," she says. "There." And then she removes the neat bands from the tips of Poppy's plaits, untangles them, and fans the corrugated waves of her hair out over her shoulders. "There," she says again. "You look incredible. You look..." She has to turn then, turn and force half her fist into her mouth. She realizes what she has done. She has dressed this child up as her dead daughter, and the result is unnerving. "You look lovely," she manages, her voice slightly tremulous. But if you don't feel comfortable in it, that's fine. Let's go back to John Lewis. We'll get you that dress. Come on.
But Poppy does not acknowledge Laurel's suggestion. She stands and stares at herself in the mirror. She turns slightly, from side to side. She runs her hands down the fabric of the leggings, plays with the sleeves of the shirt. She strikes a pose, and then another one.
"Actually," she says, "I like this. Can I have it?"
Laurel blinks. "Yes, of course you can, if you're sure."
"I'm totally sure," she says. "I want to be different. It'll be fun."
"Yes," says Laurel. "It will be."
"Maybe you could be different, too."
"Different? In what way?"
"You always wear grey and black. All your clothes look like uniforms. Maybe we should find you something swishy."
"Swishy?"
"Yes. Or colourful. Something with lace and flowers. Something pretty."
Laurel smiles. "I was just thinking the same thing myself."
Chapter 22. On Friday evening, Laurel drives to Hannah's flat, from where they will get an Uber together to the restaurant in Islington.
"Wow," says Hannah, upon opening her front door. "Mum, you look gorgeous."
Laurel swishes the skirt of her new dress. It's black, with an oriental print of birds and flowers. It has a halter neck, buttons down the front, and is made of silk.
"Thank you," she says. "Ellie helped me choose it."
An echoing silence spreads between them.
"Oh," says Laurel. "Did I just say Ellie?"
"Yes, you did."
"I meant Poppy. Obviously, sorry. All this shopping with young girls must be messing with my timelines."
"Must be," said Hannah.
"And you look lovely too,"
Laurel says, trying to leave her faux pas as far behind her as possible.
"Have you had your hair done?"
"Yes. I had a cut and blow dry on Wednesday."
"For your big romantic night out with tea, no doubt," Laurel thinks, but does not say.
"Very nice. I like it that length."
They sit in a companionable silence in the back of the minicab. It has always been thus with Hannah. She rarely feels the need to converse. It's taken Laurel a long time to lose her conviction that this is a symptom of her own failings as a mother. Outside the restaurant, Laurel breathes in hard. They're 2 minutes early, and she has no idea of what lies inside, of who might be sitting at that table. It could be any number of awkward combinations of people, the most excruciating of which would be Paul, Bonnie, Floyd, and Poppy. Her skin crawls at the very thought of it, and she wishes she'd thought to meet Floyd elsewhere first. But as they are led across the restaurant toward their table, in a glass room at the back, she sees that only Floyd and Poppy are seated, and she breathes a sigh of relief. Floyd stands to greet them both. He looks incredibly attractive tonight. He is wearing a fitted ink-blue suit, with a slim black tie, and his salt-and-pepper hair is swept back off his forehead with some kind of product. And Poppy looks refreshingly normal in her new checked shirt, worn over a fitted jersey dress with black leather lace-up boots. "They look just right," thinks Laurel. "They look like us."
"How incredibly good to meet you,"
says Floyd, his hand out to Hannah, his eyes bright with genuine pleasure. Hannah gives him her hand.
"You too,"
she says. Then Poppy follows suit.
"You're so pretty," she says. "I'm so happy to meet you."
Hannah flushes slightly at the bluntly delivered compliment and mumbles something under her breath that Laurel can't hear. They take their seats and then all get to their feet again when Paul, Bonnie, Jake, and Blue arrive.
Laurel turns her hands into fists and plasters a facsimile of a smile onto her face. She's been told by both her children not to worry, that Bonnie is a nice person, that she'll like her, that she's sweet. But still, it's a huge moment, and magnified tenfold by the presence of her own boyfriend and the impending introductions that will involve. For a brief moment, Laurel feels as though she's going to turn liquid and pool to the floor. But other people save her from herself. Bonnie heads straight to Laurel, looks her directly in the eye, presses her hands against Laurel's forearms, then enfolds her inside her soft, welcoming body that smells of violets and talcum powder, and says in the voice of a woman who has smoked and drunk and cried and sung,
"At bloody last. At long bloody last."
Floyd, meanwhile, has made his way straight to Paul to shake his hand and tell him what an honor it is to meet him. There is a moment of gentle hilarity as they realize that they are dressed virtually identically, and that they are, in fact, wearing exactly the same Paul Smith socks.
"Look,"
says Paul, pressing himself up against Floyd.
"Twins."
As onerous meetings between exes, new partners, old partners, and various children go, Laurel thinks, it really has been at the upper end of the scale. She sits between Floyd and Bonnie. Paul sits at Bonnie's other side, with Hannah at the head of the table, and Jake, Poppy, and Blue are opposite. Blue looks sour-faced and disgusted to be here, and Laurel can only imagine the emotional wrangling that Jake must have undertaken to get her to agree to coming tonight. If Blue had her way, they would never leave their cottage. But Blue is the only dark point in the proceedings. Laurel looks around the table and sees a best-case scenario. No one would ever guess, she thinks. No one would know how weird this is, how extraordinary. Even Hannah is smiling as she chats with her dad and opens his gift to her. A waiter brings two bottles of pre-ordered champagne and fills all their glasses. It feels as though someone should get to their feet to raise a toast to the birthday girls, but there is a hesitation because, of course, who should it be? Without Floyd, Paul would be the obvious candidate. Father to one, ex-husband to the other. But with Floyd, it's not so clear-cut, and the hesitation builds and builds until suddenly, unexpectedly, Poppy gets to her feet. She grips her half glass of champagne between her hands and looks around the table from person to person, her focus not wavering.
"I've only known Laurel for a couple of weeks," she begins, perfect diction, unerring poise. "But in that time, I've got to know her well enough to consider her to be a true and beautiful friend. She's so kind and generous, and my father and I are so lucky to have her in our life. And now I can see that she is not the only lovely person in her family. I know I've only just met you all, but I can feel how much you all love each other, and I feel honored to be a part of all this. To Laurel," she raises her glass, "and to Hannah, and to happy families."
There's a brittle silence, just long enough to acknowledge the strangeness of Poppy's pitch-perfect speech, the irony of her comment about happy families, before everyone else raises their glasses and says, "To Hannah. To Laurel. Happy birthday." Paul catches Laurel's eye from the other end of the table and throws her a conspiratorial, "What the fuck?" look. She smiles tightly at him. She wants to join in with his wry judging, but she feels strangely loyal to Poppy. She's young. She has no mother. She doesn't go to school. She doesn't know. Bonnie turns to her as they all put down their glasses and says,
"I hope you know I've been wanting this to happen for an awfully long time."
Bonnie has an unruly face, a wide mouth that moves in all directions at once, a dip and a curve in her nose. One eyebrow sits higher than the other,
and her chin has a scar running through it. But it all works together somehow, and Laurel can see that she is beautiful.
Yes, says Laurel. I know. I'm sorry I wasn't ready before. It was never anything to do with you. I promise.
Bonnie's hand covers hers. Her nails are short and painted red.
Of course I know that. And Paul has never spoken about you in any way that wasn't positive and generous. I've always understood. And I understand now, too. You're moving on. Because you can. You couldn't before. There's a right time for everything. Don't you think?
Laurel nods and smiles and thinks, well, maybe not. Maybe, for example, there's not a right time to lose your child. But she doesn't say it, because this nice woman is trying her hardest. And this is an important conversation, one that will set the tone for a relationship that could last the rest of her life. Paul reaches across and passes Laurel a wrapped gift.
Happy birthday,
he says. Laurel tuts.
Oh, Paul, she says. You didn't have to, that's just...
It's nothing, really.
Shall I open it now? He shrugs.
Yes. Why not?
She unpeels the paper and uncovers a book. The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
I hope you haven't read it.
No, she says, turning it over to read the back cover blurb. She hasn't read a book for 10 years.
Ooh, that book is brilliant, says Poppy.
Oh,
says Paul.
You've read it?
Yes, she replies. I read 2 books a week, at least.
Wow,
says Paul.
And you enjoyed it?
Loved it.
She picks the book up and holds it between her hands, caressing the sides of it lovingly.
It's about a boy who goes to a museum and his mum gets blown up by a bomb. He steals a small painting in the midst of the chaos and then spends the rest of his life trying to hide it from everyone. It's set in New York.
Sounds brilliant, says Laurel.
Poppy nods.
It really, really is.
Her face lights up as she talks.
I must say, says Laurel, that for a girl who thinks humanity is just a tedious mistake, you seem to have a lot of enthusiasm for novels. What is it about fiction that you enjoy?
Poppy's hands fall onto the book.
Stories, she says, are the only thing in this world that are real. Everything else is just a dream.
Laurel and Paul smile and nod. Then they turn to each other and exchange a look. Not a wry look this time, but one of disquiet. Ellie used to read 2 books a week, and when they teased her about always having her nose in a book, Ellie used to say,
when I read a book, it's like real life. And when I put the book down, it's like I go back into the dream.
Laurel picks up her champagne and raises it to Poppy.
Cheers to that, Poppy, she says. Cheers to that.
The evening is enjoyable. A success. Poppy does slightly attempt to hijack proceedings, but as she is so obviously the youngest at the table, and everyone is looking for some extra social glue to keep the whole precarious thing stuck together, she gets away with it.
What a delightful girl,
Paul whispers in her ear, as they're filing out of the restaurant at 11 o'clock.
Doesn't she remind you in a funny way of...
Laurel knows what he's going to say before the word is out of his mouth.
Yes, she says. Yes, in some ways, she really does.
That thing about the book, the reality and the dreams.
He shakes his head, wonderingly.
I know. I know, weird.
And looks like her a bit, too.
A bit, she agrees. Yes.
Funny,
he says, plucking his coat from a coat rack.
That you've found yourself in a look-alike family.
A what?
Well, he looks a bit like me, too, doesn't he?
His tone is light, but Laurel blanches. No, she says. Not really. Just the hair and the clothes. Paul looks at her fondly, realizing that he's crossed one of her many lines. The lines he knows so well.
Yes,
he says.
That's true. I like him,
he adds conciliatorily.
He seems like a good man.
Well, she says briskly, it's early days yet. We'll see, won't we?
Yes,
he smiles.
Of course. There's still plenty of time for him to prove himself to be an utter psychopath. Plenty of time.
She laughs. It's nice talking to someone who knows her better than anyone else in the world. It's nice talking to Paul.
You know,
he continues,
you know you deserve this, don't you? You know you're allowed it.
She shrugs, feeling a rush of heat up the back of her sinuses. Maybe, she manages quietly. Maybe. Chapter 23 Laurel pulls herself from Floyd's bed at 8 o'clock the following morning. He groans and turns to glance at his bedside alarm clock.
Come back,
he growls, throwing an arm across the bed.
It's the weekend. It's too early.
I need to get home, she says, wrapping her hand around his, where it lies on the wrinkled sheets.
No, you don't.
She laughs. Yes, I do. I told you, remember, I'm going for lunch at my friend's house. He feigns defeat and throws himself back onto his pillow.
Use me for sex and then just abandon me,
he says.
See if I care.
I can come back later, she says. If you can find it in your heart to let me, after my betrayal. He curls his pale, naked body across the bed, and he grasps Laurel's hands inside his, pulls them to his mouth, and kisses each of her knuckles in turn.
I would really, really love it if you came back later. You know,
he says, running her hands against the soft stubble on his cheeks. I'm getting quite close to the can't-live-without-you zone.
Really, really quite close. Is that pathetic?
The pronouncement is both surprising and completely predictable. She can't process it fast enough, and there is a small but prominent silence.
Oh, God,
he says.
Have I blown it? Have I broken a rule that someone somewhere wrote about dating that I don't know about?
No, Laurel says, bringing his hands to her mouth and kissing them very hard. Just, I'm a bit of a cynic when it comes to matters of the heart. I can feel things, but never say them. And want things, but then not want them. I'm
a pain in the arse?
Yes, she smiles, relieved. Yes, that's exactly what I am. But for what it's worth, you are absolutely allowed to not want to live without me. I don't have a problem with that at all.
Well,
he says,
I guess I'll just wait here patiently for your return and hope that by the time you get back, you won't be able to live without me either.
She laughs and extricates her hands from his.
See?
He says.
You took your hands from mine. Is this how it is destined always to be for us? You take your hands from mine. You close the door without looking back. You put the phone down before I do. You leave first. You have the last word. I linger behind in your wake.
Maybe, she says. I'm pretty sure that's how I work.
I'll take what I can get, he says, rolling back to his side of the bed and pulling the duvet over himself. I'll take what I can get.
Downstairs, the house is quiet and filled with pools of morning sun. Laurel pokes her head around the kitchen door. Poppy is not in there. She walks in, the soles of last night's tights catching against splinters in the soft floorboards, and she switches on the kettle. Beyond the kitchen window, a cat sits on the garden wall and observes her. There's a loaf of bread on the counter, a white bloomer, half gone. She cuts a slice and searches the fridge for butter. Inside is evidence of the life that Floyd and Poppy live when she's not here. The remnants of half-eaten meals, the tinfoil containers of leftover takeaways, open packets of ham and cheese and pate and pots of yogurt. She takes the butter and spreads the bread thickly. Then she makes herself a mug of tea and takes the bread and the tea to the table by the window. In solitude, she thinks about Floyd's pronouncement. She'd been half expecting it. She'd wanted it. But now that she's got it, she's worrying at it, picking at it, overthinking it. Why, she wonders, does he want me? What did he see when he walked into that cafe last month? What did he see that he liked so much? And why can't he live without me? What does it even mean, anyway? When her children were small, they'd sometimes say, "What would you do if I died?" And she would reply, "I would die too, because I could not live without you." And then her child had died, and she had found that somehow, incredibly, she could live without her. That she had woken every morning for 100 days, 1,000 days, 3,000 days, and she had lived without her. So maybe what Floyd meant was that he felt his life did not make as much sense without her. And if that was what he meant, then maybe yes. Maybe she did feel that way too. Paul had never made such proclamations. A simple, "I love you," was how he denounced the depth of his feelings. Still, she'd made him wait months before she'd reciprocated. She wipes the crumbs from the plate into the bin, places her mug in the sink, and picks up her handbag and her coat. In the hallway, she finds her shoes, last night's heels. She slips them on, wishing she'd thought to bring a flat pair. She is about to leave when she remembers the bag of birthday gifts sitting in the kitchen. Paul's book, a necklace from Jake and Blue, a bottle of her favourite perfume from Hannah. When she comes back into the hallway, she sees a figure beyond the front door. And then there is the clatter of metal as a bunch of letters is forced through the letterbox and lands on the doormat. She picks them up and places them on the console. Her eye is caught, as she turns to leave, by the letter on the top. It looks formal, probably financial. A fat white A4 envelope. Miss Noel Donnelly. The name rings a bell. She wonders for a moment why mail addressed to a complete stranger would be delivered here. But then she realizes. Of course. Noel Donnelly must be Poppy's mum. In the front garden, she looks up and sees Floyd standing in his bedroom window, his mouth turned downward into a sad face, his hands pressed against the glass. She smiles and waves at him. He smiles and waves back, blows her a kiss, draws a heart in his breath on the window pane. Paul was right, she thinks. She is allowed this. She just needs to work out how to believe it. There are more gifts for Laurel at Jackie and Belle's house that day. The twins have made her a box of chocolate truffles, some more successfully truffle-shaped than others, and Jackie and Belle have bought her gift vouchers for a spa in Hadley Wood. They've made her a cake, too. The first cake of her birthday is the Victoria Sponge, her favourite. She blows out the candles and smiles at the boys singing of Happy Birthday to You. She drinks a glass of champagne, and she tells her friends all about the previous evening, the relating of which has them both agog. They tell her that she looks glowing, that her hair is shining, her eyes are sparkling, that she has never looked better. They say that they will invite them over for lunch next week, her and Floyd, and Poppy too, maybe, that they cannot wait to meet this man who has brought light back into their friend's world. And all the time, Laurel is thinking that this feels like a normal Saturday at Jackie and Belle's, but also not like a normal Saturday at Jackie and Belle's. Because for the first time in years, there's an energy somewhere outside her own body, an energy that belongs to her, yet isn't of her. It calls her and it pulls her, and instead of lingering after tea and cake as she normally would, instead of trying to squeeze as much normality out of her time with her oldest friends as possible, she finds her hand on her handbag at 5 o'clock. Words of thanks and farewell coming from her mouth. Her friends squeeze her hard in their hallway, and there's a sense shared by all of them that things have changed, as they changed all those years ago when Jackie and Belle told her they were a couple, as they did when Ellie disappeared, as they did when the twins were born, as they did when Paul left. The ebb and flow of need and priorities was moving things along again, and Laurel knows that she will not need her Saturdays here as much as she once did. She climbs into her car, and she drives as fast as she can, back to Floyd's house. The letter is still there, on the console when she walks in, but someone has crossed out the address and written, "Return to sender, /not known at this address," on it. The name shouts out at her again. Noelle Donnelly. Noelle Donnelly. Why does she know that name? "How was your lunch?" asks Floyd. "Lovely," she says. "Really lovely, look." She shows him the box of homemade truffles. "The boys made these for me. Isn't that sweet? And we're invited as a couple next weekend, if you want to go."
"I'd love to,"
he says, hanging up her coat for her, and then her scarf. Poppy rushes downstairs at the sound of Laurel's return and throws her arms around her.
"Oh," says Laurel. "That's nice." "I missed you this morning," she says. "I thought I'd see you."
"Sorry," says Laurel. "I had to rush home to get ready for lunch." Floyd has opened a bottle of wine in the kitchen and poured Laurel a large glass, which sits on the kitchen counter waiting for her.
"Funny," she says absent-mindedly, swinging herself onto a stool. "I think maybe I might know someone who used to live in this house."
He puts the wine bottle back in the fridge and turns to her, an eyebrow raised.
"Oh, yes?"
"Yes. There's a letter on your console. For Noelle Donnelly. And I can't for the life of me remember how I know the name, but I do. I thought..."
She treads carefully. "For a moment, I thought maybe it was Poppy's mum." Floyd doesn't move. After a minute, he turns towards the fridge and says,
"Well, actually, it is."
Laurel blinks. She remembers Poppy's description of her mother's red hair, the smell of grease.
"Was she Irish?"
she asks.
"Yes. Noelle was Irish."
Laurel stares into her glass at the undulating reflections of halogen lights in the surface of the liquid. There's something wriggling beneath her consciousness. Something about the combination of the name and the hair colour and an Irish accent. And she knows this woman. She knows her.
"Did she have any other children?"
she asks.
"Older children?"
"Maybe she was a mum at the school."
"No. Just Poppy."
"Did she work round here? Locally?"
"Well, kind of," says Floyd. "She was a tutor. Maths. I think she taught a lot of the local kids around here."
"Oh," says Laurel. "Of course, that's it. She must have taught Ellie. Ellie did have a tutor for a while.
A short while, anyway. Just before... Her words peter out.
Well, says Floyd. What a remarkable coincidence. That really is. To think that our paths came so close to crossing. Just one degree of separation.
Yes, says Laurel, her hand tightening around the wine glass. What a coincidence.
She mentions it to Hannah when she phones her on Monday.
Remember, she says, when Ellie had that tutor, the year she disappeared.
No,
says Hannah.
You must do. She was Irish. Tall woman, red hair. She used to come on Tuesday afternoons.
Maybe.
Laurel can hear her typing as she talks. She swallows down a swell of irritation.
Well, weird thing, she continues. But turns out that she was Poppy's mum.
Who was?
The tutor. The maths tutor.
There's a small silence, and then Hannah says,
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember her. Ellie hated her.
Laurel laughs nervously.
No, she says. She didn't hate her. She thought she was wonderful. Her savior.
Well, says Hannah, that's not how I remember it. I remember her saying she was weird and creepy. That's why she stopped the lessons.
But,
Laurel begins, pausing to try to order her memories.
She didn't say any of that to me. She said she needed more time to study other things, or something like that.
Well, she told me she didn't like her, and that she was creepy.
There's a note of triumph in Hannah's tone. She and Laurel had always vied for Ellie's attention.
Anyway, says Laurel. Isn't that strange? What a small world.
She's talking in lazy clichés, using words that don't quite add up to the sum of her disquiet. In the hour since discovering that Noelle Donnelly was Poppy's mum, Laurel has remembered more and more about her. The slightly hunched back, the stale-smelling anorak and sensible rubber-soled shoes that squeaked against the tiled floor in the hallway. The nervous imperiousness. The pretty red hair left unbrushed and pushed back into clips and claws. She cannot reconcile that woman with Floyd. He may not be a classically handsome man, but is groomed and stylish, fragrant and clean. How did they come together? How did they meet? How did they fit? And how, more than anything, did they make a baby together? But she doesn't say any of this to Hannah. She sighs. She's been overthinking things as usual, and now she's run out of steam.
How did you enjoy Friday night? She asks. It was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. It was nice, actually. Just to be together like that. Thank you.
For what?
For organizing it. For suggesting it. For being the first person in this family to do something brave since Ellie went missing.
Oh,
says Laurel, taken aback.
Thank you.
But I think you have Floyd to thank. He's the one who's given me courage. He's the one who's changed me.
No,
says Hannah.
You've changed you. You wouldn't be going out with him otherwise. I'm really pleased for you, Mum. Really pleased. You deserve it.
Did you like him, Hans?
Floyd?
Yes.
Yeah, says Hannah. Yeah. He seems okay.
And that, coming from Hannah, is praise indeed. Chapter 24.